Would like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Alan M. from L.A.
Don't do that, man. No, go ahead, go ahead. I was waiting on that. My name's Alan. I'm an alcoholic. And it's but for God's grace, I'm clean and sober tonight through the program of recovery that's outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I've used as my personal program of recovery. I haven't found it necessary to have a drink in 10,073 days today. But who's counting, you know? I share that because of a story I heard in my home group of Alcoholics Anonymous about a man who had 40-plus years of sobriety. He retired from the L.A. area, moved back to Detroit, Michigan. He stopped going to meetings, he stopped being of service, and he picked up a drink after 40 years. Within that first year of him drinking, he died as a direct result of the disease of alcoholism. And when the old-timers attended his funeral in Detroit, because you have to understand he was a man of good standing in AA for years, they asked his wife, who had 30-plus years of sobriety, how could he possibly relapse with 40 years? And she simply replied, he might have had 40 years, but he didn't have enough days. And that made good sense when I opened up the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it tells me what I get is a daily reprieve from drinking contingent upon my fit spiritual condition. It's a one day at a time program for me. I want to thank the trusted servants of this meeting that asked me to come out and participate in my recovery. I am from the Los Angeles area of Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group is 4808 Crenshaw Boulevard, Back to Basics Group. My home group is the Men to Men Stag on Thursday night, Iron Sharpens Iron. I'm okay today. There's no dark cloud on the horizon. Ain't nothing bad happened yet, you know. They ask us in the Big Book to share in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like today. And the best way to describe this part of my story is that I was born and raised in a We Never Closed city in a We Never Closed state called New Orleans, Louisiana. Oh, you can tell, huh? Its most famous street is named Bourbon. And there's one day of total alcoholic insanity, and it's called the Mardi Gras. I was born and raised in a Catholic household. I'm the youngest of four kids. I was a newcomer at the Salvation Army Harbor Light Center, 809 East 5th Street, which is Skid Row in Los Angeles. And I was in one of my first meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with about 30 to 60 days of sobriety. And this guy was speaking at the meeting, and at the end of his pitch, he said, tonight, in the quietness of your own room, get down on your knees and ask your higher power or my higher power to show you your relationship with alcohol and or drugs. And ask him to show you what it had done to you and what it had done for you. And what it had done to me was that I was in a Skid Row recovery program. That's what it had done to me. But what it did for me gave me the ease and comfort that the previous speaker was talking about. But my higher power also has a sense of humor. And what he disclosed to me that night was this. My older sister, Joni, is a pharmaceutical sales lady. She works for Merck Pharmaceuticals. Her husband is an attorney who has his own private practice and was the legal counsel for the Port of Baton Rouge. And their idea of going to get a $6 hamburger is getting in this 29-foot speedboat and lowering it down on the Tickfaw River and going 30 miles inland to where we go to this hamburger shop and get off the boat and we get a $6 hamburger. Then we'd get back on a boat and go out in Lake Pontchartrain and we'd ski or fish the rest of the day. But they did that repeatedly on Saturdays for a $6 hamburger. My older brother Curtis is a certified public accountant. His wife worked for a stockbroker in New Orleans. And they have a 5-bedroom home and a jacuzzi in their backyard and a lake, a jacuzzi in their bedroom and a lake in their backyard. And on those hot, humid nights in New Orleans, there would be a button on the side of the jacuzzi that they would press and the roof would retract. So it would give them the feeling that they was outdoor in their jacuzzi as opposed to being in their bedroom. My older sister Eileen is a former prosecuting attorney for Los Angeles County. Her husband was director of the Brotherhood Crusade, and she had just bought him for his 55th birthday a brand new Shadow Rolls Royce. But he didn't drive it because he had a driver that picked him up in his town car every day and brought him to work. But he would use his Rolls Royce to go to his Oceanside home in Montecito or continue down the 101 to his 50-acre ranch in Lompoc, California. My name's Alan. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's my success story, okay? Now, we was born and raised in the same household, both parents. My mother and father, to the day they died, argued who finished the second grade and who finished the third grade, okay? He was a porter in the L&M Railroad. She was a sales lady at a department store. But they sacrificed everything that they could have had and made sure that we had the best opportunity to have the best education possible. I was born and raised in a Catholic household, so I went to Catholic high school. We all went to the same Catholic elementary school. Me and my brother went to an all-black Catholic high school, and my sisters went to integrated Catholic high schools. You know, and they would study all day, 8 hours a day at school, and come home and jump right back in the books. I would study 8 hours all day at school, and I'd come home and turn on the TV. It was either Gilligan's Island, the Big Valley, Bonanza, something like that, you know. And to this day, I'm still trying to figure out who really got with Mary Ann, you know. And sometimes I would look at the Big Valley and I'd be somewhat confused. Is Heat Barkley finer than Audrey Barkley? I don't know, but they both look good to me at times, you know. So. After that, I would just go run and play basketball and hang out all night until it was time for my mother to come home, and I would beat her home, do my homework, and act as if I had been there since I got out of school. You know, and my brothers and sisters today, they're all retired and real successful. And I thought 3 out of 4 wasn't bad. If you're doing 75% and 3 of your kids are real successful, then you winning, you know. So when I look at my relationship with alcohol, they went right, I went left. I put everything into that lifestyle where they put everything into that side because there was a reward at the end for them. But my reward, as long as I can remember, was instant gratification. It didn't make a difference what it was, whether it was football, TV, sports, alcohol, any other type of move. I love instant gratification. And I couldn't get it fast enough. And that cycle continued. I started drinking at the age of 13. My friends and I was going to a party. It was a Friday night. We had gotten out of school. We had made a plan that we was going to go to the We Never Closed liquor store on St. Bernard Avenue. That's the name of the liquor store because it never closes, right? And there was always this wino outside named Harry the wino. And we would give Harry, and we're minors, our money, and he would go in and get our wine. So the first night out drinking, we bought 4 bottles of wine. Real Sangria, Thunderbird and Grapefruit Juice, TJ Swan, and Mad Dog 2020. Yeah. See, I'm in the right place. Yeah, because we went through the TJ, we went through the Sangria, we went through the Thunderbird, we was a block away, and we had this pint of Mad Dog 2020, which I suggested that we get, so I was responsible for killing the bottle. So I turned it up, and it started coming up, and I got my first suggestion. If it tastes bad, hold your nose, and you won't taste it, and drink it straight down. And I took that suggestion. And about an hour later, we're in a party. And back then, I know some of you newcomers don't know, we used to have albums. We had phonographs that went in circle, and we put a needle on it, and music came out of it. I'm trying my best to describe this to you. And the last thing I remember is going down the opposite way of a soul train line, trying desperately to get out this house, and I passed out right on these people's kitchen floor. And back then, it's like they knew whose house I was going to. I couldn't go unless they knew the parents. And the generations of people, my sisters and I, we all knew everyone. So I woke up outside with no shirt on. It was the middle of the winter, and my friends picked me up, and they brought me home, and they rang the doorbell, and they ran. They ran. They did not want to be there when Mr. Curtis and Miss Orita answered the door. Because, see, I'm the baby of the family, and my mother was sure to blame them than me. She was going to think you was a bad influence on me, as opposed to me being a bad influence on myself. And that's how I grew up, the baby of the family. He can do no wrong. It wasn't his fault. It's those people he's hanging out with. It's that job that my mother protected me, suffocated me, enabled me, you know. And what I learned since I've been here was that what I had was a lack of any type of emotional sobriety. That I loved you because you're my mother, not because I felt that attachment. And that's how I was until I got here into this program. So that next day or the day after, I can't remember when I came to or woke up, I knew I had to pay a price for my conduct, for getting drunk and embarrassing my parents, because it was big on embarrassing them. You're an embarrassment. Why would you do that? You know, can't ask a drunk like me why I do stuff. I don't know why I do stuff. I just do it. You know, and I sat down in his kitchen, and they looked at me, and they shook their head. And to my surprise, they said, "Alan, if you're going to drink, you can't embarrass us like that. You need to learn how to hold your alcohol. You need to put some food on your stomach before you drink. You need to stop drinking that cheap wine and drink something better." And I'm like, am I hearing this? I grew up in an environment where drinking is a part of that society. Like I said, there's no last call for alcohol. It's a 24-hour-a-day city, and drinking is prevalent. If you was to stand on a corner of my mother's house right now and do a 360-degree turn as Creole Bar, Pete's Bar, Teeny's Jazz Room, and Al's Jazz Club, and my father, grandfather, and my older brother went to these establishments every day after they got off from work, every day, and so did I. Once I became legal age drinking, 15 in New Orleans, is legal, basically. They allow you in bar rooms, right? And I used to drink with my father, and I used to drink with my brothers, and I was underage, but everybody knew everybody. And my drinking took off. It escalated through high school, through college, you know, through my career. You know, there was a lot of ominous warnings. You got to stop passing out. You got to stop throwing up. You got to stop wrecking automobiles. You got to stop dancing and taking all your clothes off, son. You can't do that, you know. I hung out in these bar rooms and learned how to shoot pool, shoot dice, play poker, talk out the side of my neck. And let me tell you, these old men used to lie. You got to watch old timers in these rooms because they still got some game with them, right? And I believe these old men. They gave me all the game. And then as I grew old, I realized they lied all the time. They didn't do that. It was impossible. But they was my, you know, they was my heroes. You know, I mimicked myself after them. And what happened when I got into my late teens and early 20s, I went to school with three or four individuals from kindergarten through high school. We're the best of friends today. Three of us are sober. One of us is not. And the other two are preachers. They really had it bad. They went straight to Christ. They got churches, and they're on TV. And I'm telling you, boy, I thought I had it bad. But apparently, I found AA, and they found religion. You know, but we're sober, you know. Our routine every week was this. Monday night, we go to the Exchequer on the lakefront. Tuesday night, we go to the Touch of Class. Wednesday night, we're at the Club Famous Disco. Thursday night, Sport Night, we're back at the Exchequer. Friday night, we're at the Le Boucherie. Saturday during the day, we're going to any wedding reception. Whoever's getting married in our neighborhood, we crash their wedding receptions. Saturday night, we went out with our girlfriends to the Club Silver Dollar, and all day Sunday, we stood on the lakefront drinking beer and playing football. And we did that every day for about 5 years straight. That was our routine. We always had a cup in our hand or an ice chest in the trunk of the car. And we continued that pattern and that behavior. And once my early 20s and mid-20s start coming around, I shouldn't have been doing that. I had responsibilities. I was with a woman. I kept saying she got pregnant. I know the day we got pregnant, okay? That was a hard way to put it. We got pregnant. I still practice that. We got pregnant, and we decided, you know, that it was time for me to grow up. We made that decision. I don't think I participated in that decision. But I recall her saying, we made a decision. You was going to not do that no more. And I came up with my first idea. I'm going to leave New Orleans. I'm going to go to a place where they don't drink like that. So I moved to Los Angeles, California. Only thing I knew about Los Angeles was palm trees and beaches and Disneyland. You know, and then when I got here, you know, it was like I was okay. I was living in Pasadena with my sister. We were living in this 5-bedroom, 2-level house with a swimming pool and a tennis court and a basketball court and a sauna. And I thought we was fine living there. My wife had other problems. You know, she had other ideas. You know, she was pregnant. She wanted to get our own place. I'm like, why? We got a jacuzzi, a bedroom, a sauna, a swim. They're not asking us to leave. Why can't we just stay with my sister? You know, and one Saturday, she just took all the money and got us an apartment on Crenshaw in Manchester. I'm like, man, I'm back in the hood. You know, I thought I had arrived, you know, but during that time, I started working in Santa Monica, and I did what I had to do. What I recall people doing was like, you're the man, you need to handle this. So I took the bus every day for 6 months from Pasadena to Santa Monica and back. Never missed a day of work. Never was late a day of work. You know, did really nice work, got paid, got bonuses. You know, I proved to the world that I could handle this situation, because when I left New Orleans, it wasn't pretty. I made that decision to leave, but I had some help from the NOPD, the paramedics. My father kind of recommended I leave. I said, what, you want me to leave from the neighborhood? No, I want you to leave, son. Go as far as you can away from here, you know. So I was doing all right for a little while. And then the old behavior came back. And now the exchequer turned into the Carolina West. Touch of class turned into the player's choice. You know, the club famous disco turned into Red Onion. And I start visiting the same places, hanging out with the same people who I hung out before. But now I'm married with a wife and a kid. And I went straight downhill. It didn't take long for me to wind up in my first alcoholic recovery program. And for you people that's dual addicted, if I say something like, I carried a TV at 2:30 in the morning, 4 blocks to get a bottle of alcohol. You're going to have to kind of read between the lines on that, right? This is I do my best to adhere to traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how the old timers taught me. So if I carried a TV at 3 in the morning to go get a bottle of alcohol, that's left up to your thinking, not mine, right? And it just got worse and worse, and I wouldn't see it. In September 18, 1987, let's say September 12, 1987, I got a call from my brother-in-law. He said, your mother then sent you some money so you can come back home. She understands you're not doing anything you're supposed to. Your wife and kid then left you. You need to come back home. So I said, well, when can I get the money? They said, well, you come tomorrow. So I called. They said, well, he's not here. So they pushed this all the way to Friday. It was a Monday. And I got my cleanest, dirtiest clothes on because I wanted to look presentable, you know. And I walked from Crenshaw and Slauson all the way to San Pedro and Slauson, which was like about 4 to 5 miles, because I wanted that $187 my mother sent me, because I had a plan, right? And I went my brother-in-law's office, and he wasn't there. His secretary was there. And prior to giving me the money, she said, well, you need to sign this. And it was a promissory note to pay my brother-in-law X thousands of dollars because they co-signed the car, they co-signed the furniture, they did all of this, and I just totaled everything, and he wanted his money back. And at that point in time, I'll sign whatever you want me to sign for $187. Because I had a plan. You know, and the door opened up, and I turned around, and it was my brothers and my sisters. They had all flew in from New Orleans to do an intervention. And the first thing that came to mind was, does this mean I'm not getting that $187? I mean, first thing that came to mind wasn't like, hey, I'm happy to see you where you are. Am I not getting this $187? And say, no. No, you're not. Okay. Matter of fact, we have a facility for you to go into. And they brought me to 41st in Compton, and that was my first alcoholic recovery program called Bricks Kicks. And they had a basic philosophy in Bricks Kicks. And B, better understanding. R, responsibility. I, individual concern. C, coping skills. K, keeping the information in front of you. S, self-discipline and self-control. And that was their basic philosophy in order to get sober and stay sober. Didn't happen. Didn't happen to 91. The big book tells me if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life was sufficient for me to overcome my disease of alcoholism, I would have recovered a long time ago. That I can wish to be moral, that I could wish to be philosophically comforted, but the needed power as marshaled by my will alone is not sufficient. I failed utterly, obviously. What's my dilemma? Lack of power. So I have to find a power in which I can live by. On my own, that philosophy could not work for me. I was too far gone. The next 4 or 5 years, I spent the same time doing the same thing. I get out the facility after a year. I get a good job. I get the wife back. I'm going to do a geographic. I'm leaving L.A. I'm going to move to the Valley. I moved to Witsit and Victory because there ain't no alcohol and drugs out in Witsit and Victory in the Valley. That's my thinking once again. And what happened? I crashed and burned. My wife starts finding those little 99-cent bottles of vodka all over the house, in my coat pocket, in socks. And I became a closet alcoholic, scared for anybody to know I didn't relapse, but dying inside. Dying mentally, physically, but more importantly, spiritually, because I don't want to fess up that I had messed up. And I tried to keep it together, but I couldn't. I'll be a real alcoholic. I can only hold it together so long. I can fool you for a little period of time, but sooner or later, the conversation catches up to me. And it did, eventually. In and out for 4 or 5 years. May 2nd, 1991. I'm in a place called the Gates Motel on 79th Figueroa. And one more time, I rented a room, $10 for 2 hours. I was doing that $10 for 2 hours for 15 hours in a row. Why didn't I just give the people $40 straight up and stay the whole night? But my mind, the morals and principles I was raised by, the times I had been in the facility, I knew what I was doing was wrong, and I kept on saying, this is it. I'm going to do this, and then I'm gone. I'm going to do this, and then I'm gone. And I did that 1,000 times, you know. But that night, one more time, I'm in this bedroom by myself. I didn't put the dresser in front of the door because they're after me. I didn't took the spread and put it over the windows so they couldn't see me. I was butt naked. And I wasn't expecting no company either. That's pretty much how my last day in my disease was, you know, and I had a moment of clarity. And I didn't know what a moment of clarity was. Don't get it twisted. I did not know. I just know I started turning down this alcohol and it started coming back up and I wasn't getting the ease and comfort that I needed right now. And that scared me more than anything else. Because when I can't rely on alcohol, that means I can't rely on nothing. Alcohol carried me through situations most of my life that the love of my parents couldn't, that the love of my wife or the love of my kids couldn't. Alcohol was a constant. And like Bill said, My drinking and speculation commenced to forge, through my drinking and speculation, I commenced to forge a weapon that would one day turn itself in flight like a boomerang and all but cut me into ribbons. And alcohol started to cut me into ribbons. I left that place. I went to the payphone on the corner. I had about 35 cents left. That's when they had payphones, newcomers, on the corner. You could put quarters in it and make a call. Okay, we didn't have cell phones and pages, stuff like that, okay? And I called the program that I had been in four previous times. And they said, we got a bed for you. We've been waiting on you. And they said, we'll come get you. I said, no, don't come get me. I still got a little bit more to drink. I'll be there. And I walked from 79th Figueroa to 41st in Compton. 2:30 in the morning, I checked myself in the facility. I threw my last bottle out under a bush, and I put myself in this program. And this is the first time I voluntarily went in because I had no more ideas, no more plans. I knew I was going to drink again, but for that time, for that moment, that seemed to be the only place I wanted to go because it was familiar. And that familiarity, did I say that right? I need some water. I can't open it. All right. Once I got there, after about 2 weeks, they was allowing the H&I panel to come in, and it was the 12 steps. I had never heard of 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. This was not a 12-step program. They had their philosophy. That was it. They wouldn't allow 12 steps, but now they were. And I got interested in these H&I panels that was coming in. What I really got interested in was that same panel leaders came in with, like, the same jewelry on every week. This one guy had a watch I kept looking at for 3 weeks, and it's like, it ain't gone yet. It must be something to their story, because I'm listening, and people like him and me don't hold on to jewelry that long. I got interested, and they mentioned something like, you know, you can sit back there on death row if you want, but if you need to hear the message, you might want to creep up. You can keep coming in and out of these facilities, but unless you're willing to do some work, you're just wasting good, they say, wasting good dope smoking time. I didn't say that. They say that. But you're wasting, you know, and even the big books say, if you don't think you're an alcoholic, go to your nearest bar room and take a drink. Put it down, take another one. And if you can drink like a normal drinker, our hats off to us, because Lord knows I've tried. I've probably tried for each and every individual in this room to successfully pull us off. Moving, geographics, different females, no kids, have kids, great jobs, terrible jobs, walking to the liquor store, getting chauffeured to the liquor store. I mean, I've tried it. All. And in the end, only thing was left was a little bit of hope. Not a lot, just a little bit. And that's what the 12-step H&I panels gave me, a little bit of hope. And after 30 days, this guy said, Alan, you might want to leave this program and go downtown to the Harbor Light Center, where there's 12 steps every day, every night, Bible study. You know everything about this facility. You come in. They let you run the kitchen, then you start escorting the clients to the hospital. Then all of a sudden you lead in groups again, and then everybody's relying upon you for this and that. And that was the truth, because within a structured facility, I can do that. I can get in a facility, and I swear I don't cuss, I don't get in trouble, I obey all the rules and regulations, I don't relapse while I'm in there. But as soon as you let me out, I don't know what happens. And I didn't know till I got here and opened up that book that said there'll come a point in time I'll have no mental defense against that first drink. I didn't understand that until I got here. And I did not have any mental defense after I left the facility and I drank. And I only start thinking about that first drink after a series of drunks. And I would say, how did this happen again? And it happened. I put up a little fight or whatever. So I left there and went to the Harbor Light, and I got into the 12 steps. I heard that story, you know, about what alcohol had done to you and for you. You know, I also heard this story about, I was sharing with this woman one time about all these situations I was having with my wife at the time and this and that. And, you know, she's saying she needs $450 for child care. I'm like, child care don't cost no $450. The kids, that small. They don't eat that much. If you buy them diapers and they don't eat, I mean, I was adamant. I'm not knowing. And this lady said, Alan, you got your big book with you? I said, yeah. She said, go get it. I went, go get it. She said, turn to this page and read what we had been going over the last month. And I read it. They said, Alan's like the actor who's forever arranging the scenery and the rest of the players. If people would do what Alan want, all would be well. Alan might be kind, modest, sacrificing, considerate. Or Alan might be mean, egotistical, depending on the situation. They say, well, what is Alan's basic problem? That Alan, in his best moments, is a producer of confusion rather than harmony. And I swallowed hard. I understood that the disease of alcoholism, my God, has more to do with drinking. It's the way I perceive life to be, and it's the way I think life should be, and it's totally screwed up. And the only way I could resolve these issues about the way I think, because the way I think is the way I act. When they say turn my will in my life, they say turn my thinking and my actions over the care of God. The only way to do this is to put down on pen and paper a four-step inventory to see my resentments, my fears, my sexual conduct, my behavior. You know, and then freely admit it to someone else other than a priest who's not going to talk to anybody else, who's not equipped to help me. I did a fifth step with a priest at a church, and he closed his little blind. For true. I'm like, I didn't know God closed. He didn't want to hear no more, you know. It's like, oh. You know, I often wondered, I was a pretty little boy growing up. Why they didn't mess with me? Nah, I don't know. That's just a thought I had. You know, sometimes, you know, I need a little money now and then, you know. I know, huh? Went over their head. I got busy into the 12 steps. And I made a decision. Like the guy that took the 1 year. I made a decision. Congrats. I made a decision that I'm gone. Set up the meeting, make the coffee, greet the people, clean up after the meeting, pick up the cigarette butts. And if I don't like what I have after 365 days, I can refund my misery at any 7-Eleven in South Central. I think 365 days, 1 year, is enough time to see whether I want this program or not. And if I don't, I just walk away. And I go on to the bitter end, or maybe I stay sober and continue. But I'm going to do everything this first year. Not necessarily because I want that 1 year cake. I need to know if this program can work for me. So I got busy in the steps. It don't make no sense to be in the 12-step program and don't work the 12 steps. I mean, it's just, I wouldn't do it. Why come in on a Saturday night? No. Let me get busy. And if it don't work, it don't work. But at least I've attempted to do something. Because even if I couldn't see my disease in its worst nature, my parents could see it. Their baby boy could see it. You know, that they could see it. My brothers and sisters could see it. The people I work for, they could see it. I was the last one to see it. And the reason why is that this lady told me, Alan, you can't see the picture if you're sitting in the frame. You need to take yourself out the picture and see what we're looking at. It don't look good. You know, in your own mind, you think everything's fine because you've been living like that since the age of 13. But it's not, you know. And I got busy. And in getting busy, I got sober. And in getting sober, I got some real good friends around here. And in getting some real good friends, what happened is that my self-esteem raised. I started to become confident in myself. That ex-wife told me after 3 years of sobriety, she was going out the country and she was going to bring the kids to me in Vegas. It was January. They was going in May. I'm like, that's way in May. I might be drunk by May. She say, you ain't drinking no more. I don't know what's happened. Something has changed in you. But I'm more than sure you're going to be sober when May comes. It was July 1992 when I really swallowed this entire program. I was at a friend came in from New Orleans. He was by his father-in-law on 82nd in Vermont. It was the 4th of July, and he was barbecuing and making all his food. I was in a men's living facility. We call them sober living homes. And I lived there for about 2 or 3 years because patience is the key in my recovery. Yeah, I'm going to get it. I just need to wait and be patient. It's going to come when God wants me to have it. So he started asking me if I wanted to take home all his food, and I'm like, yeah. He gave me turkey, ham, some ribs, yams. I mean, I'm 2-3. And he said, you from New Orleans, right? I said, yeah. He said, I got something in the refrigerator for you. And I knew it was going to either be banana pudding, a lemon meringue pie, or sake tummy cake. And he pulled out a red and white can and said, here. And it was a Budweiser. And I looked back and I went, it's too early for me to start drinking. I didn't have time to tell him I suffered from a mental obsession, a spiritual malady, and a physical allergy of the bottom, and that I work a triangle and a circle with that. So I didn't have time to break down the program in a triangle. The shit was scrambled in my brain, but the best I can come up with was that it's too early for me to start drinking. And he understood that, because I'm taking all this food, but I don't want to drink with him. Now, you don't do that, right? And I was leaving, and there's a passage in the book, and I was in this car, and the sun hit the window, and it hit me on my face. And I remember that quote saying, I stepped into the sunlight at last. I could say no, I'm not drinking today. I can say no, I'm not participating in that today. And I don't care if you like it or not, because I met a friend here. His name is God. I met someone who looks out for me even when I don't look out for myself. I thought I stopped drinking when I got into this program. But really what happened when I went to the Harbor Light and they closed that door and they separated me from alcohol and drugs, that's when I stopped. So I beg the question is this program designed for me to stop? No. This program is designed for me not to start. Because if I don't start, I don't ever have to worry about stopping again. So it's all about that first one because I have an allergic reaction to alcohol. Forget the last one. It's the first one. So in the 10th step, it say I review my day where I could have been more kind, considerate, and helpful to others. And upon awakening the next morning, which is the 11th step, I see what I can bring into this world as opposed to what I'm taking it. Because I've been a taker all my life. My biggest problem in recovery is that I've become my mother. I'm an enabler. I got kids, and when they're in trouble, I just can't say no. And I understand what my mother went through with me. I don't see the adults. I see the baby. So my program ain't perfect. It never will be. But I don't see the adults. It's like, you 23, get a job, do something, buy a car, leave me alone, stay out my pocket. You know? And then they give me that look, man. It's like, all right, man. I'll help you out, you know. But I love them because I love myself, you know. I love myself. I don't say that enough. Maybe you should say it to yourself. I don't love myself enough. But I need to say it. Man, this has been a journey. I do anything any free man. I go to a destination, all-inclusive resorts. Let me back up. At certain periods of my sobriety, my higher power and I got together and allowed me to do some things. Now, at 2 years sober, I couldn't go in a casino. But at 15 to 27, maybe later on tonight. Maybe. No, I'm just saying I can do that without screwing up. You know, I go to all-inclusive resorts. And, man, I can't eat all that food. Most of that's for people who drink, but I enjoy myself. I was able to give my daughter away. you know, and be at that wedding reception. I went to my son's wedding just a few months ago, and he had a child recently. I'm a grandfather. I came in here. I didn't wear glasses, and I had hair. I did. I have a picture. Now I'm a grandfather all of a sudden. Don't rush your sobriety. Trust me. As you get time around here, the years go by real quick. And you find yourself from newcomer to old timer. But I can't trade this life I have for any life in the world. But I had to first look at the problem in order to get some idea of what the solution is and to continue to move forward to help other people. You know, my life is basically, it's a book I read. It's called My Autobiography in 5 Chapters. And the first chapter is I'm walking down the street and there's a large hole and I fall in it. I didn't know the hole was there. Chapter 2 is that I'm walking down the same street. I know the hole is there, and I fall in anyway. I have forgotten. Chapter 3 is that I'm walking down the same street. I know the hole is there, and I fall in anyway. It had become a habit. Chapter 4 is that I'm walking down the same street. There's a hole there. I know it's there. I do everything to get past it, and I don't. What do? I just jump in because I had become powerless. Chapter 5 is, I simply walk down a different goddamn street. My recovery has been simple as that. I was never getting anywhere going down that street, so I followed another street. And what happened? I found God, and you can too. And he'll meet you at the steps. Thank you for allowing me to share.